is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon. Warwick Long indeed in the chair today, asking if you've sold any cattle lately. Beef prices have been sky high and they're only getting higher. We're going to look at this today with a farmer and an analyst. But one of the main questions being is, are Victorian farmers missing out on the highest and the best of the prices? And if so, why is that occurring? We're going to look at that and more. I'd love your thoughts. If you're producing beef at the moment, what do the high prices mean to you? What are they meaning for the business decisions that you've got to make? And does it mean you're selling up a little more or a little earlier than you usually do? 1300 977 222 is the number if you'd like to join us. You can call 1300 977 222. You can also text 0467 842 722. Would love your thoughts on the country. Yeah, that text line always open to you, 0467 842 722. We'll also have a look at lobster prices, which are on the rise, and water is soon flowing into Lake Menindi as well. We'll find out what that means from the minister involved shortly. But let's start today with breaking news in the dairy industry, with the industry today walking away from $700,000 of work investigating whether it can roll policy, advocacy, R&D, research and development, and marketing into one organisation. Since 2019, industry groups have been working on the Australian Dairy Plan, with a key outcome being to create a single whole-of-industry body, combining that advocacy work with the industry services, basically combining what's known as Dairy Australia, which gets all the government and compulsory levy funding, together with Australian Dairy Farmers and the Australian Dairy Industry Council, which does the lobbying to government for changes in the industry as well as elsewhere. Well, we can reveal to you that the reform is not progressing in that way. The industry's identified all of those functions cannot be performed by a single organisation, which is what government was saying all along. Peter Somerville spoke with Australian Dairy Farmers President Terry Richardson to find out more.
The key reasons that for a single whole of industry reform model that we were contemplating not to proceed is that restrictions prevent the use of levies for agri-political activity, and it couldn't accommodate the requirement for independent representation, and it would compromise government investment in research, development and extension.
So what was the straw that broke the camel's back here, so to speak? This work has been progressing for a while now. Why are you announcing now that this isn't happening?
What we're announcing is that this particular piece of work will cease, but dairy organisational reform remains an industry priority, and that will continue. Our longer-term objectives haven't changed. All we're doing is changing step and the path to achieve that outcome. But first and foremost, the farming sector needs to resolve the organisational funding issues. That was another thing, Peter. So it was, how do we fund that agri-political activity that farming organisations seek to undertake from time to time?
What's the answer there, or how will you find that answer?
Well, the ADF will now lead a group comprising state dairy farming organisations, and we'll consider how to optimise the policy and advocacy arrangements, and in particular the funding arrangements, and this will be led by David Palmer, and we will come back to the industry with a proposal in due course.
I'd like you to just have a listen to this audio from the Minister, David Littleproud. He was speaking on this issue this week. He says that the industry needs to fight its own battles when it comes to agriculture.
What I support is that the Australian taxpayer and the levy payer pays for research and development and marketing, and that should be what that money goes towards. The representation and strategy of the industry is that is owned by the industry, not by government. Government shouldn't interfere in that. I think that industry itself has to own its own industry. Government can't interfere in everything, can't solve every industry's problem. This is their industry. They need to own it. They need to lead it. And their members need to be passionate enough about that to be involved in it, because if they do, then you have a strong industry group that will be able to be loud and clear about its aspirations, its challenges that it wants governments to face up to.
What do you say to that audio? Is it news to you that the minister didn't support that, or have we known that all along?
Look, we've been in discussions with the minister throughout this process, and I have to say that he is very supportive of the dairy industry, but at the same time, he's always recognised the need for a strong and effective peak body. But as he indicated there, under current policy settings, we can't fund agri-political activity with the levy fund. And this is a broader public policy issue which we've discussed with a range of stakeholders, and any shift in that policy would involve more than just the dairy industry. So we're clear, we understand the position that the Minister's articulated there.
Does the industry have a strong enough voice when it comes to advocacy? Are farmers engaged as much as you'd like them to be?
Well, look, farmers are engaged, and these are the challenges that organisations such as ours are facing these days. There's pressure on the federated model of representation. See that in our sector and across the wider community. Changes in our farming community, how we connect and communicate. We see that there's declining membership. Sometimes we talk about the level of participation, but it all translates into the resources that we have available to deal with an increasingly complex range of issues. And it's even more important for dairy policy positions to be developed and advocated for. So it was that view expressed across the industry that the current arrangement won't meet the future needs of the industry, and this is what all this work is focused on and addressing.
So with that in mind, what happens next on this reform journey? It's been made pretty clear that advocacy must stand alone, but will any of the other organisations merge?
I think what we are keeping in mind is the longer-term objectives, the views expressed from across the industry that there needs to be closer collaboration between the various organisations that we have in place now. But it's a matter of how do we make that happen, given the we just talked about the regulations or the framework that we operate under. It's a complex issue. We know what we would like to achieve, but there is a journey to be undertaken to get that final outcome.
That is Australian Dairy Farmers President Terry Richardson speaking there with Peter Somerville. As you heard, the industry is now anticipating more consultation on the steps forward. What do you make of that, though? The dairy industry went through this huge Australian dairy plan. It's one of its main key recommendations, really the one spoken about the most, was the idea to combine all these groups into one. And now, today, they've announced they're walking away from that. Does that make this process void? Has it not been worth it, or is there still an outcome that you think is valuable to the dairy industry? You can call 1300 977 222. You can text 0467 842 722. You might like to use those numbers to talk to send us your thoughts on the next thing we're speaking about on the Country Hour, because we're moving away from dairy and on to beef right now. It's 13 past 12. And beef prices are hot right now. You don't need a market tool to tell you that, but it is amazing to look at. As the name suggests, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator roughly tracks how much buyers are paying for young cattle up and down the East Coast. And it's booming. Each day this week, we've had a new record. Today, the Ecky, as it's known, has hit 910.17 cents a kilogram. So how high can it go? And what does it mean for your business decisions? You can call 1300 977 222. Matt Dalgleish is from Thomas Elder Markets, calls himself Meat Watcher on social media, has certainly been watching the rise of these markets. Welcome to the Country Hour.
Thanks for having me on, Warwick.
How high can the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator go? It's almost pointing upwards in its trajectory at the moment. That means prices are on the rise. How long can this go on for?
Look, I think we aren't far away from a top for young cattle, Warwick. At the end of the day, producers that are looking at buying these animals are going to have to, you know, at some stage consider what they're going to turn them off for. And when you do the numbers purely on a grass-fed trade, I think around that 920, 930 cent a kilo level would be pretty toppy based on where the finished steer prices are likely to be when you're turning off.
So that's 10 cents higher than what it is at the moment. So in your view, well, 10 to 20 cents higher, to be fair to your comments. In your view, we're almost at the peak now. When do we hit that peak? Is this long lasting, or is this high period of prices short lived?
I think we're going to see it this season. I wouldn't be surprised that we see it kind of as we head in further, a little bit further into winter. So I think we might just grind a little bit higher and get to those levels. But I'd be most surprised if we, you know, kind of head up towards that 950. That'd be just making the numbers not work if you're looking at making any money out of this type of a trade.
What's behind the meteoric rise of the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator at the moment?
Part of it's a story of the tight supply that the market and the industry was well aware of leading into this season. But this most recent move has been really, if you look at the breakdown of buyers and sale yards that are driving this young cattle price move, it's mainly been the rain we saw up in the northern areas. So obviously that was quite disruptive to parts of New South Wales as a short term when we saw the flooding. But some of the rain into Queensland really got the restockers in Queensland quite active. And if you look at the breakdown of this most recent 9-10 cents price, pretty much 50% of what's driving that market is three markets, which is your Roma and Dalby in Queensland and the Wagga market in New South Wales.
I'm going to get into the detail of that with you in just a moment. Stay there. Matt Dalglish from Thomas Elder Markets. Let's bring in a farmer now to talk about what it means on property. Michael McCormack is a beef farmer in the Talangata Valley in northeast Victoria. Michael, welcome to the Country Hour.
Yes. Well, thanks, Warwick. Yes, thanks for the opportunity.
Huge prices for beef cattle this season. What does it mean for you on farm? I suppose before really you go through what it means, tell us about your operation first.
Yeah, well, Warwick, we're basically a feeder steer operation. We run an autumn and a spring herd to spread things across. But, yes, we had a wonderful break in February, which we're all very nervous about whether we're going to keep it or not, and got a little bit tight a couple of times, but we're still going. So, yes, we're having quite a nice time with, as Matt said, higher prices and also the season. It's been remarkable.
So when you have great prices as a producer, who I imagine you've got set times, you're joining at a certain period of time, you're weaning at a certain period of time, you're selling your cattle at a certain period of time, can you change any of that to capitalise on the higher prices?
It's very difficult, Warwick. Breeding operation, you're on a path, really. Our autumn calving cows, they're joined to calve on the 1st of March, and we turn weaners off in early January, and then we have the second herd calves on the 1st of August, and we're turning calves off now. So I'd love to be organised and get them to have two calves a year. That'd be really good at the moment, but I just haven't got that sort of ability at the moment. I wonder whether anybody could fix that for me. But I agree with Matt. I think what we're seeing recently with the rains in the north and so forth seems to have kicked and put another floor in the market. If they hadn't have got that rain, well, we might have been on a bit of a slide. But everybody talks about the herd rebuild. We're at record low cattle numbers in Australia, and that can't happen overnight. You buy a heifer, it's basically 12 months gestation, well, 9 months gestation, but it takes you 12 months to get a calf on the ground and best part of another 12 months to have that product, that feed a steer, to be able to put into the market. So as a producer, we're tied into that cycle. The calves that we got good money for this year, well, it was 2 years ago that we basically built those calves. So we're just about in the process now. We're 23rd of May as our joining time, which is getting very close. But again, like I said, we're doing that for the future. That's 2 years away.
Yeah. And Michael, just in terms of that, I think you've buried the headline here. You said you're selling off weaners basically now from your August joining herd. Can you tell us, have you been getting good prices since we're talking about record beef prices at the moment? Have they been performing well when you've been selling them?
Well, they certainly have. Our operation is a little bit unique. We push genetics a lot. We push yield and marbling. So it makes those steer weaners a reasonably sought-after product. So we're sort of aiming at that higher end of the market. But I have some calves locked up at the moment, weaning locked up and feeding those. They rang me this morning and said they're going on Monday. Started on the 1st of August, went to the middle of September, so they're quite a tight group. But, yes, the price per kilo I shouldn't say enormous. Perhaps that's what we should be getting for them. But
go on, spit it out. What is it?
We were up at $6.35 for them, so that's a pretty good price.
And how does that compare historically to what you've been getting as a producer?
January calves made just over 500 cents. So it was a lift on January, but, perhaps I'm getting old, but it's not that far in the past that, we got $2 and thought we were, on a high mark then. But, yes. But what we're looking at now, as I said a minute ago, is a supply and demand job. Our cattle herd numbers are down. A lot of people, especially in the north, are buying heifers and joining them. But so they must have a bit of confidence in the market to join those heifers to be at least 18 months to 2 years away before they get a product to sell. So,
And that's a big hope that those prices will remain hi. I suppose then, as a farmer, I'm really interested in your views then of the business decisions that you make. You've got high prices for this last lot that you sell. Does that mean you have more money to invest to pay for better genetics again, better bulls for the next season? Or do you put work into your farm, or do you just cheer that your bank account is going to be higher in the end?
No, probably the first two points are pretty correct. Yes, pushing genetics. I bought a bull this year to put through the herd, and he is a high EMA and a high marbling bull with quite a bit of growth in him. So that's pushing that whole envelope a little bit more. What really drives us is our season, and we're with a good season, we're able to put weight in calves earlier than what we usually have without visiting too much hay sheds and silage rolls and so forth. So that has all been good. But, yes, we've got to be positive because we don't know anything else.
That we should finish on that then, shouldn't we, Michael? That's a perfect summary of a farmer's position.
It is an opportunity, though, to invest back in pastures and so forth and fertiliser and seed. Here in the northeast, we've had a few properties come up recently, talking something like $15,000 an acre, not a hectare, an acre, and that sort of stuff. So, there is certainly some confidence and investors in the market.
Certainly. So, Michael McCormick, thanks for joining us, and thanks very much for letting us pick your brain.
Thank you.
That's Michael McCormick, who's a beef farmer in the Talangata Valley, talking about how he's faring and the business decisions that he's making. I can't say decisions today, with high cattle prices. On the text line, we've got some interesting thoughts coming in too. This one says lower beef prices in Victoria is because of not enough competition, collusion between buyers, mateship between buyers, says one text. We'll put that to Matt Dalgleish in a moment. And another one's asking, some are talking about an orderly decline in pricing of 10% per month between now and September. What is the view of the panel on this? Plenty of questions coming for you, Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets. I will come back to you on that last point, that text are thinking there's going to be an orderly decline of 10% per month for, 4 or 5 months for now. That's quite a lot in terms of prices. Is that likely to happen?
Oh, look, I did see actually some analysis that came out suggesting that might be on the cards, but I think historically, Warwick, when you look at cattle market declines, I'd suspect a 10% decline on a monthly basis for the next few months would be very much out of the ordinary. Generally speaking, on average, when you see a declining market for cattle prices over the whole season, so over the year, you're saying about a 15% decline would be about normal. So 10% per month for a number of months seems very excessive.
Now, I did want to talk to you about Victoria and if it's missing out on the very best of these prices as we go through this period of records for the beef industry at the moment. There's an article by our market reporter, Jenny Kelly, in the Weekly Times looking at where a lot of the figures that make up the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator record come from and how really a lot of the weight behind the high prices at the moment is coming from Queensland and markets further north of Victoria. In your view, is that the case?
Yeah, that's spot on. So the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator is a weighted indicator. So it looks at about, I think, 28 sale yards across Victoria, New South Wales and Queensland. But then obviously the yards that have the bigger volumes going through, they get a higher weight. And indeed, those Queensland and northern New South Wales ones are the ones that tend to drive it most times.
So are Victorians missing out on the best prices then?
If you look at the kind of pricing, Victorian, the biggest sale yard from volume for Victoria is Wodonga. And so you've got the headline ecky of 910 yesterday, but the average price for that type of ecky cattle in Wodonga was 834 cents the same day. So, yeah, significantly lower than what the headline figure was.
So Victorian cattle at their best are 80 cents a kilo behind the northern price, and probably more given the northern price would be dragging up the average.
Yeah, that's right. I think the best Victorian yard yesterday was actually not far from you, Warwick, at Shepparton, at very close to 870, and that was the closest that we got to the headline of 910 for Victoria. But bearing in mind that the Shep market's, you know, less than 1% of the ecky weighted average, so that's where those lower volumes kind of don't tend to contribute as much then to the headline figure.
Can I quickly ask you then, we've talked a lot about young cattle at the moment. The ecky is something followed widely by industry and widely by those outside of industry as a really indicator on how cattle markets are going and where prices are at. But what about other types of cattle? How are they performing, and are those prices extraordinarily high as well?
Historically, yes, they are. We've seen, if you look to, I guess, the final stages, the heavy steer is the next one I look at when I'm looking at markets. And obviously because, you know, the cattle are bred for a purpose, as we know, and it's the heavy steer indicator that's the final purpose, those animals that go off to be processed. And so that market is actually, it peaked back last season at 388 cents a kilo live weight. And we're currently sitting at 373. So not far from the nominal peak. We're about 70 cents higher than where we were this time last year. So last year we were close to that 300 cent a kilo live weight mark. So very strong prices across the whole of the cattle types. And that's really reflective, as Michael was saying, one is the good season, of course, but the other thing is that very tight supply that we knew was coming.
So what are you watching from here, and what should farmers be watching from here?
I think from a longer-term perspective, the Australian market does tend to follow what's happening internationally. We do get these cycles when we have very wet seasons or very dry seasons that we move away from what's happening internationally, but generally we always do tend to gravitate back to that once we get through our seasonal kind of conditions that are extremes. That's international markets is one I'm focusing on heavily. But from a more local perspective, I think that heavy steer indicator is a crucial one because particularly for what drives the young cattle prices, like I alluded to earlier, Warwick, that when you're looking at running the numbers and buying young cattle at plus 900 cents a kilo carcass weight, the farmer and the operation that they're doing, whether it's going into a feedlot or whether you're growing it right the way out to a finished steer, you know effectively what kind of weight you're putting on per day and when you're likely to turn them off. So, the only unknown factor is what price am I going to get in a year's time when I'm turning off these animals, these one that I'm putting weight on. And so that's crucial. And I think you know, from that perspective, that's where the heavy steer indicator comes in. And our forecasting at Thomas Elder Markets for this season is actually to see a very gentle decline in heavy steer prices over the season. We're looking at something like a 5% decline, you know, over this year. So probably going from that 370 level live weight down to about the 320, 330 level, which historically is still very strong prices.
Matt, thanks for your time today.
No worries, Warwick.
That's Matt Dalgleish, who is from Thomas Elder Markets, taking us through his thoughts on the high beef prices we're experiencing at the moment. And as I said at the start, Eastern Young Indicator today, new record, 910.17 cents.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
News headlines are on the way shortly. After that, the weather. Would love to know how much rain you've had in that last burst we had across the state. Anything substantial, let us know. You can send a text 0467 842 722. Trevor's done just that. He's had 9.5 mil in Barul in Gippsland. Trevor, hope I've said that correctly. Not familiar with it. Had to look it up just north of Gippsland there by the looks of it. Gippsland, just north of Leangatha there by the looks of it. Bernard has sent a text about the dairy plan. We had a story earlier about the Australian dairy industry walking away from really one of the main things that it decided in its Australian dairy plan, which was to create this one whole industry organisation. It's been decided that's too difficult, so lobbying and a lot of the industry functions will be kept separate. Bernard says the dairy plan has ended as expected. They have learnt nothing. They left farmers behind in the process. The ADF is a black hole which the industry orbits around. It sucks in good ideas and people and crushes them. This had so much potential, but failed leadership would not let go of their entrenched culture and ideas. Just very sad, says Bernard. Bernard, as you heard, though, Terry Richards has said there was a lot of reasons why that change couldn't have happened because of things like government rules around where the money goes. But we'll take your comment as well, and we'll take any of your comments. You can send a text 0467 842 722. Let's head to news headlines, find out what's happening around Victoria and beyond right now. Rio Davis is there for us. Rio?
G'day, Warwick. Making news, the director of a new clinical trial program in regional Victoria says she hopes the service will help close the gap between regional and metropolitan health services. The new trial hub program, which opened in Gippsland yesterday, will offer more than 300 clinical trials in 14 different disciplines. Program director Anne Woollett says they hope to expand the program to Bendigo and Rosebud by the end of the year. The Victorian opposition leader has backed calls for changes to allow doctors to use telehealth to consult terminally ill Victorians on voluntary assisted dying. Under the Commonwealth Criminal Code, doctors who use telehealth to consult on euthanasia face fines of up to $222,000 for sharing suicide-related materials. But Michael O'Brien says regulatory barriers to telehealth consultation should be reduced. Murray Plains MP Peter Walsh has lashed out at the state government's COVID requirements for Anzac Day. COVID restrictions mean many regional Victorian RSLs have cancelled marches, despite some still holding services. Mr. Walsh says he's now telling veterans to do what they need to do to pay their respects to those who have served Australia. Regional towns from Victoria's High Country to Gippsland will soon have better digital connectivity after securing $2.6 million from the federal government to install a new fibre optic cable. The cable will stretch for 42 kilometres and will be faster and more reliable than the previous cable. Vacant land owners in Greater Bendigo could soon be forced to pay double what a normal ratepayer would under a new draft budget released last night. It's being proposed as a solution to help deal with the city's land shortage. And platypus have been spotted at Lake Benalla again after it was drawn down earlier this year to help combat an aquatic weed. Goulburn Broken Catch Management Authority says the lake has been slowly refilling and should be back to normal levels in the next couple of weeks. For more regional news at any time, you can visit ABC News online.
Thanks, Rio. Rio Davis there with ABC News headlines. Ask and you shall receive. We have plenty of your rainfall figures coming in now. I can give you some of those. Here we go. 25 mils at Tynong North from Jill. Appears to be our best. 10 millimetres at Camperdown. Looking good from Paul. 12.5 here at Hexham, says Ned. 24.8. So you're just short of Jill at Tynong. Nigel had 24.8. In Vespa, rainfall at Addington, just outside of Ballarat, 6 mils. says Graham. Keep those figures coming or your comments coming to the Country Hour 0467 842 722. Let's go to the Bureau, though, and see how that matches up with some of their work. Duty forecaster today, Michael Lathco, can join us. G'day, Michael.
G'day.
Rainfall came through the state a fair few places yesterday. We've got between 10 and, well, between 8 and 25 mils, really. Is that about what you saw?
That's a good broad way to describe it for much of the state. We did see a little bit more in the Yarra Ranges area, with our highest being 37 millimetres at Mount Donavuang. But other areas like Ararat did record 22 millimetres and 22 at Kinglake as well. So all through those Grampians and southern parts of the Great Divide, I've got some pretty reasonable totals. A bit less north of the Divide, though. They generally had less than 10 millimetres, and up in the Mallee in the far north, it was very little indeed, so generally less than 2 millimetres along the border, unfortunately.
And has most of that left us today?
That has largely left us today. There's still a bit about East Gippsland, but otherwise it's looking like a fine and dry remainder of the day. However, there is a front approaching, and that's forecast to move across the state tomorrow morning and into tomorrow. So, again, south of the Divide is likely to see probably 1 to 5 millimetres, mainly about the coasts and about those ranges. Again, less than 2 millimetres in the Wimmera, but they'll probably see a little bit there, and dry about northern Victoria and East Gippsland as well, most likely.
And beyond that, how are we looking?
Beyond that, generally Friday, Saturday and Sunday, showers about the southern half of the state and the ranges, less than 5 millimetres each day, but something. But north of the Divide, very little. So generally dry conditions expected. Then early next week, we're forecasting a high-pressure system to move over again. So some very cold mornings, but dry and settled conditions for Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday.
And I suppose warnings-wise at the moment around the state, given a look that front has left, is there much there that we should be aware of?
Now that that front has left, we've cancelled all of our cold weather warnings. That risk has ceased. But there's still warnings if you're out on the water today. So most of the coastal waters do still have fairly strong winds either tonight or tomorrow. One thing to note is that a fairly heavy swell is forecast to move into southwest Victoria on Thursday night and into Friday. So some pretty big waves, maybe 7 metres of wave moving onto the southwest coast tomorrow night.
One there for the surfers, probably more important for the fishermen, but good to give them a mention as well. Michael, anything else we need to know before we let you go?
Nothing too much, just it's starting to get into frost season again, so those temperatures are getting down. Last night was quite cold, but tonight and the next few days should be a little warmer than the temperatures we had last night.
Well, brilliant. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Michael Lathco there at the Bureau of Meteorology, taking us through the weather for the next few days and how things are looking. Interesting reactions to our story on the dairy plan, going through that process and coming up with a plan to change and now walking away from one of those key recommendations. Someone says in response to the text from Bernard, spot on Bernard. Another one here says, Warwick, have a lot of respect for your reporting, but again, Terry and the ADF are looking for scapegoats. It failed because they could not agree on anything, had no plan from the outset, and they should have removed processes, needs and wants until they sorted out what the farmers wanted from a restructure. I have a model that would have worked, says this text. Well, you might get an opportunity. We shall see. You're listening to The Country Hour. Next, we'll talk water.
On ABC Radio Victoria, you're with Warwick Long for the Victorian Country Hour.
You would have seen the torrential rain falling in the eastern states in the last month or so, from flooding on the coast heading out towards the Pacific Ocean. There was also flooding inland. Unfortunately, some of that northern rain has been making its way into the Darling River and is now snaking its way to the Menindee Lakes east of Broken Hill. About 650 gigalitres of water is expected to arrive in the lake system soon, adding to the 371 gigalitres, which is already there. Under current rules, once the volume of Menindee Lakes passes 640 gigalitres, control passes from the New South Wales government, which is running the site at the moment, to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, a federal authority. That management system is controversial because during the last big flows into Menindee, the lakes filled but then rapidly emptied to meet demand downstream in the Murray-Darling system. New South Wales Water Minister Melinda Pavey is in Broken Hill for the Western Division's conference in Broken Hill at the moment. She explains here what the plan is for water going into the lake system and what can be expected from here.
You're with... We're going to be opening those gates and seeing a big flush of water. As we know, there's about 371 gigalitres currently sitting within the lake system. And, you know, at least 650, maybe more. It's going to be full. It's going to be delightful. And then I suppose the next question is, when do I have to hand it over to the Commonwealth? And yes, I will have to. That's the rules. I don't necessarily want to. And we've been managing it and keeping that water as back as much as we can. Lake Victoria is actually full itself. But I do hope, and I've had this conversation and we'll be having it again with my federal water minister. So my plea to the Commonwealth, to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, to the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, can we just be a bit more respectful to communities when we make decisions and why we're making them? Because I know the people of Menindee deserve that water as much as those in Adelaide deserve it. It will sustain the lakes for a couple of years, and everybody wants as much water to be kept there for that community to enjoy.
You sort of hinted on the latest figures on what sort of flows are coming down. What are the latest figures to you, what we're expecting?
Well, we're hearing 650. Secret squirrels are saying maybe 850. Yeah. But it's a bucket of water. So on top of what we've got, that's 1,000 gigalitres. And that's, you know, nearly two Sydney harbours.
So will we see Lake Menindee fill up? Will we see a functioning lake again?
That's what the figures are saying. And the photos will be glorious. And let's bring back the wildlife, the bird life, enjoy and celebrate this time.
That is New South Wales Water Minister Melinda Pavey speaking to Marcus Wilson about the gates opening for Lake Menindee, the Menindee Lakes filling as we speak, and more so tomorrow when those gates open. That brings us to a conversation we had yesterday on the Country Hour. And remember, if you miss a Country Hour episode, you can always go and subscribe to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts or in the ABC Listen app, and you won't miss an episode that way, and you won't miss our discussion yesterday where we talked about Victorian politicians, local government officials, business leaders and farmers who have returned from their trip up the Darling River, and they're looking for change in the management of the Murray-Darling. We're about to hear a response to their views, but if you missed it yesterday, here's a summary of what was said.
It's sort of an unlevel playing field, and I suppose, you know, we're up there to highlight to our people that it isn't fair.
All of those plans are looking at managing the environment in their own valley, which is terrific, but nobody is thinking about what they need to contribute downstream. And everybody sees it as somebody else's problem to provide water to the Darling, whereas that needs to be decided on collectively to ensure there is water coming out of each valley.
So you want figures on what's coming out at the end of each river as it enters the Darling?
Absolutely. Each valley's got to contribute.
You know, the Darling always made a contribution and it's not.
Often the argument is if you have evidence of wrongdoing, put up, and if you don't, after a trip like this, shut up. What would you say to those concerns?
Well, I'd say we've got an Inspector General, for goodness sake. What's he doing?
That is independent member Susanna Sheedon, farmers and business leader. She was on a trip up the Darling River speaking on the Country Hour yesterday. So what do those in other states think, especially those in New South Wales and above? Jeremy Morton is the chair of the National Irrigators Council and can join us now. Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Warwick, and congratulations on the new gig.
Thank you. Those who we spoke to yesterday have returned with strong words, saying things like it's unfair, questioning dam builds and infrastructure, and saying they want goals for end flows from rivers, all the rivers entering the Darling. Is that reasonable?
Well, I think we'd all like to think that every valley was actually contributing. The reality is sometimes it rains and sometimes it doesn't. And the tour they've been on, obviously, to the Northern Basin is a very, very variable part of the Murray-Darling Basin. And sometimes it contributes a lot and sometimes it contributes very, very little. And that's mostly related to the amount of rainfall and the variable rainfall they get.
So from what you heard yesterday from those farmers who went up the Darling and say, we're from Victoria, we've got concerns, particularly how the Northern Basin is operating. Are there fair concerns for a group of irrigators who are from the south where it's highly regulated to going up north where it's not and saying that there should be some changes here? Is that a fair enough position?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that it's absolutely fantastic that they've taken the time to actually go up and have a look and understand. And I think they acknowledged yesterday that, it is a little bit difficult to understand how those different systems work, but they are very, very, very different systems. And I think one of the key things that I think was a challenge for them was they've gone with this mindset or this view that the Darling contributed more water than it has actually historically. So the figure of 39% is one that's been thrown around a lot. That figure is just plain wrong. The actual reality is that on average 12% of the flows in the Murray River at Wentworth is about 12%. The median is 8%. So 50% of the time it's more than 8%, 50% it's less. And that's over 125 years. So if you're going with a mindset that it used to contribute 39 and now we're seeing very little, well, you've got to actually start in the, with the actual hard facts, and that is that the Darling doesn't contribute 39%, it's 12%.
So I suppose what's your position, your group's position, on particularly the management of the rivers that enter the Darling and the Darling itself? Is it just wait for rain, or are there things that can be fixed here or improved here, particularly as we're waiting for water resource plans from areas like New South Wales at the moment?
Oh, well, I think one thing that we have learnt, and, it's been actually enacted in New South Wales, is the protection of those first flows that after a rain event, and there were plans in place that allowed irrigators to access that water straight up. Now they those first flows are protected, and I think that's really important. That's one thing. If we do look at the water use that's occurred in the Northern Basin, one thing that the regulation or the works that have been carried out on the floodplain and on the rivers in the Northern Basin, one thing it has actually impacted on is those really low flows. And you can see that with the flow data at the bottom of the system. So if we can protect those really, really low flows, and they are now, that's a critical first point. The next thing is, if it doesn't rain, what can you do? I mean, one thing I did hear them say was, that they weren't, that it's not contributing enough. The reality is a lot of people in the Northern Basin and down into even the Murray over the last few years have had zero access to water, zero allocation. And for people in the Goulburn Valley or the Victorian Murray who've been at worst case on 66% and 80% during that dry period, to say someone who's got nothing isn't contributing enough is a little hard to reconcile.
Well, Jeremy Morton, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Chair of the National Irrigators Council, Jeremy Morton, taking us through a bit of response to our program yesterday. And as I said, you can go and listen to that. We spoke to irrigators, business leaders and state politicians about their trip recently up the Darling River. It is 13 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. And let's take you away from water. Let's take you away from beef prices. Let's take you away from dairy industry conjecture. And let's talk lobster prices now on the program. Have you become used to eating crayfish at a cheaper price since the Chinese bans on seafood? Well, you might now have to start paying a little extra. Southern Rock Lobster beach prices, the price paid to fishermen by processors, are at the highest they've been since China banned Australian exports. Processor Andrew Ferguson says fishermen are currently earning above the $50 a kilo mark, well short of what they were getting before the trade to China was lost, but still better than what they've received recently. He told Bridget Herman that tighter local supplies is one thing driving the price rise.
Other countries like New Zealand, particularly for the export market, it's not just in a break, it's just starting to come back again now. But, about the 50s, mid-50s thereabouts, I think, at the moment. So, yeah, it's been sort of a bit of a high point than it has been over the last few months. Anyway, that's for sure.
How high is this compared to since China blocked Australia from trade?
Oh, well, certainly not to that level. I think at that time it was more up around $100 a kilo beach price. But still not where a lot of people would like it to see it. That's for sure.
Is this the highest it's been since then?
Yes, it is. It is. It's the highest I've seen since end of October last year, I guess.
And you said it was sort of to do with the supply that's available. How much quota's been caught here in the southern zone?
Yeah, well, that's part of the problem, I suppose. Everyone's finishing up and there's not many fishing. And it's the end of the season and, yeah, it's just this old supply and demand. There's not much supply for the marketplace across the markets that we've got left. So it's actually, you know, good in some ways, but not if we everyone was fishing. I don't think it wouldn't be the same, that's for sure.
And do you expect these higher beach prices to hold on until the end of the fishing season?
Well, who knows? It depends on a whole lot of factors with other suppliers around the world, because we're in a world market and we see New Zealand come back now. They fish the winter and Tasmania fish winter time. So, yeah, it's hard to say. It's always hard to know. You never know.
Does it look like China is interested in restarting trade with the Australian lobster market?
I don't know. I think they probably are. I think they would probably like to have our product, because we've a lot of products now gone out of the market, having Australia not to supply it. And I know the price in China for similar species like ours have gone up a lot in value. So, yes, I'm sure they would, but, you know, they're actually where our product's been locked out. So, you know, no, I don't think we won't be seeing any product go back in there in the short term anyway.
So, are you looking at finding new export markets still, and how is that going?
Yeah, we're searching the world in our methodology of what we have at our fingertips on the computer and whatnot, but not travelling, obviously. We've got bits and pieces with trials going across the world, a bit into America and that, virtual trade shows and whatnot we're doing at the moment. But, yeah, without samples on the ground and people on the ground, it is a bit difficult.
That is Ferguson Australia's Managing Director, Andrew Ferguson, on the higher rock lobster, higher crayfish, higher prices that they're experiencing above the $50 a kilo mark. It's 9 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Let's go to meet a fresh face in industry lobbying in Victorian agriculture. Now a whirlwind. That's how Danielle Cucinotta has described her first 4 months as the newly elected Victorian Farmers Federation Vice President. Ms. Cucinotta is a third generation caged egg farmer in Werribee South in Melbourne's West. She spoke to Eden Henninen about what she's learnt from her travels over the past few months and what she's hoping to bring to the role.
Mid-December, I was elected as the Vice President, which was very exciting and very overwhelming. Little unexpected. And since then, I've had a whirlwind of new agricultural experiences. So I come from a egg background. I'm a caged egg producer in Werribee South. So all of a sudden, I realise everything I knew about eggs was only this tiny proportion in such a large scale of agriculture in Victoria. So I've spent a lot of time brushing up very quickly on all forms of agriculture, which is pretty exciting. I'm very excited to be here.
What are you hoping to bring to the role?
Oh, so I guess being a caged egg farmer, I'm not shy of controversy, and animal welfare issues is something that I've spent, say, the last 5 years fighting for and ensuring the farm is seen in a good light. So, you know, we love what we do and we're very passionate, and we spend 24 hours, 7 days a week with animals. So it's going out there and showing the average consumer that's what we do and it's what we love, and we're here to do the right thing and best practices happening on farm. Being a caged egg farmer, there's lots of bad raps or like negative reviews around that. So a couple of years ago, my family and I, we wanted to create that transparency, but not necessarily break biosecurity. Like, you just can't let everyone in the sheds, but we wanted people to be able to see that it wasn't necessarily what they'd seen on these awful videos on, say, social media. So we actually created a virtual reality program for our farm, which was great fun. And I do lots of community engagement programs where I go out, we take the headsets, we've gone to schools or community groups, and we go through what happens on our caged egg farm, and then we debunk the myths of farming. So I'm hoping to bring that kind of concept to agriculture overall.
And you've been touring the state for the past 6 weeks. What have you stumbled across and learnt in that process?
That Victoria is so much bigger than I first thought. And we've gone out speaking to individual farmers and seeing at branch meetings, but we've also had the opportunity to speak to local councils. So going out and discussing rates and the increase of rates and how that's affecting our farmers in those regional areas. We've also been able to firsthand see the roads. And so I actually drove in the Loddon River Bridge. I drove over the Loddon River Bridge, and we've actually requested a $2 million upgrade for that area. But there are so many roads in regional Victoria that definitely need upgrading. So we're here to advocate for that.
Are you working on anything else exciting at the moment?
I've been very fortunate to work with the Kids to Ag project at the VFF. So we are encouraging schools to take on this $2,000 grant, up to $2,000, to go visit local farms and take children from primary schools to see firsthand what happens on a particular farm.
That's Danielle Cucinotta, who is the new VFF's vice president, speaking there to Eden Hennenen. Market time, let's get into it with Lean Gather Cattle. Here's Brendan Fletcher. G'day, Brendan.
G'day, Warwick. There are 100 more at 1880 with the usual buyers operating in a mixed market. Quality was mixed with many lots showing the cold weather. Trade demand remained solid. Grown steers and bullocks sold firm. Manufacturing steers sold generally firm. They were a little mixed. Heavy beef cows sold firm, while lighter dairy cows eased 10 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 524 to 619 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls eased 6 to 10. Grown steers, 368 to 412. Bullocks, 370 to 399. Heavy Frisian steers, 308 to 330. Crossbreds, 312 to 385. Most light and medium weight cows, 200 to 275. Heavyweights, 245 to 319. The better shaped heavy bulls, 274 to 323. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan. Let's go to Hamilton, the lamb market there. Here's Chris Agnew.
Agents yarded 10,746 lambs at Hamilton this week, light 12 to 18 kg lambs, 1 and 2 scores, 90 to 160, averaging 650 to 1100 cents. The light trade weight lambs, 2 and 3 scores, 18 to 22, 140 to 186 to average between 730 and 800 cents. The medium trade weight lambs, 22 to 25, from 166 to 210, and they average between 730 and 800 cents. Heavy trade weight lambs, 26 to 30 and over, made up to 248, and they average between 720 and 780. Hoggets, the 3 scores, made up to $190. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. Let's go to Warrnambool Cattle now. Good afternoon, Eric Estrain.
There were 182 less cattle penned in the plan to average quality offering of 617 head at Warrnambool. The few vealers available to processors sold from 430 to 460 cents. Restockers paid mainly 420 to 468, with the tops at 478. Yearling heifers purchased by the processors made 344 to 444 cents. Restockers paid 360 to 420 for heifers and up to 476 cents for their run of steers. A small and plain offering of grown steers were from 360 to 368 cents. Restockers paid to 410. Beef cows sold from 280 to 320 cents. The dairy cows 252 to 275, and lean condition cows made 194 to 256 cents, with poor to plain quality from 190 to 238. Beef bulls were mainly around 280 to 288 cents, with a sale out to 310. It's been Eric Estrain reporting for MLA.
Lucky last is Graham Palmer at Horsham.
Good afternoon, everyone. Lamb supply fell this week with 7,950 yarded at Horsham. Quality was mostly good. Quality medium and heavy trade weight sold from 185 to 210. Heavy lambs reached 273. Medium lambs were in good numbers and sold from 158. Sorry, merino lambs were in good numbers and sold from 158 to 224. They've averaged 780 to 800 cents to be dearer. Sheep numbers eased to 2,650. A big run of 250 plus merino weathers in a big skin sold at $270. Heavy Merino ewe sold to $240. Crossbred ewe sold to $264. The trade weight lambs 18 to 22 kg sold from $150 to $179, average $800. Medium trade weights 22 to 24 kg sold from $183 to $199. They've averaged 800 cents. Export 3 and 4 score lambs 26 to 30 kg sold from $211 to $233 at around $775. Extra heavyweight export weight lambs 30 kg plus sold from $233 to $273. The medium weight sheep 18 to 24 kg sold from $120 to $158 with running merino mutton averaging around $660. Been Graham Palmer at Horsham from LA.
Thanks very much for that, Graham. And we couldn't find a Wodonga market report for you today. My apologies. We'll try and do better for you on the same day next week. That's it for the Country Hour today, though. Thank you to all you for sending messages and thoughts into the program. I'll try and make more room for them too. It's 1 o'clock.